The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. You may be familiar with the name Allison Law. She is an Atlanta-based writer and self-proclaimed book evangelist. She contributed to the Bitter Southerner Summer Reading Roundup and joins us later this hour to share her recommendations. Plus, WABE's Rose Scott talks with the manager of Little Shop of Stories about the store's newly formed banned book club. First, as the school year comes to a close, our team at City Lights has summer reading recommendations, thanks to Bunny Hilliard, the owner of Brave and Kind Bookshop in Decatur. The shop has a wide selection of children's and young adult books, with some offerings for adults, too. Bunny joins me now via Zoom to share her list of age-appropriate book recommendations. Bunny Hilliard, welcome back to City Lights.
Thank you so very much for having me. I am super excited to be here, and I can't wait to share some fun new reads that have come out recently and will be coming out during the summer that I know young readers and their families will love.
Well, how did you decide which books to include in this summer reading list?
That's a good question. These are books that are either on my to-be-read list that I pulled off to make sure that I could share them in a time that folks would be able to enjoy them. They are from some recent book selling events that I attended where I was able to see those authors come and present their books, and I was just floored and so excited to add them to our shelves. And then, you know, at Brave and Kind, our goal and mission is to celebrate diversity and inclusion in the stories that we share. So that's always top of my list.
Sun is Also a Star by Rick Reardon and Mark Oshiro. It is for middle grade students. What can you tell us about that book and how it's related to the Percy Jackson series?
So I'll say, you know, fans of Rick Riordan are rejoicing in a choir-like fashion right now as some of their two favorite characters, Will Solace and Nick D'Angelo, have their very own book. And so this book was co-authored with award-winning writer Mark Oshiro and is entitled, again, The Sun and the Star, A Nick D'Angelo Adventure. And the fantastical trials and adventures continue as Nico and Will Solace together set out to rescue a friend that was left behind in a past escape from the underworld. So I'll be honest, I just signed an NDA to get my eyeballs on the pages of this book. It is held very close because it's so dear to so many fans. They dare not let any words leak out of the pages before it's time. But we are all so excited for the next chapter in this Rick Riordan adventure.
Why did Rick Riordan want to co-author the book with Mark Oshiro?
That's a really really good question. I know that they are going on tour together, and that's a question that I will plan to ask them myself. I will say that I know that Mark is a brilliant author, award-winning, who's written books such as Anger as a Gift. They've also written David Bravo, You Only Live Once, and recently Into the Light. And so I know that over the years, Rick Riordan has been teaming up with brilliant young authors to co-author books and to, I believe, just widen the appeal, the audience, and the excitement around some of these new, young, upcoming authors.
Nick Blake and the Remarkables is by the internationally best-selling author Angie Thomas. And this is her middle grade debut. In what ways is this story informed by African-American history and folklore?
I really enjoyed reading this book. I'm so excited that Angie Thomas has penned a middle grade book that younger audiences can enjoy. It follows the story of Nick Blake on her 12th birthday, where she receives a hellhound puppy for a pet and is on the cusp of learning how to use her gifts as a manifester, the most powerful of the supernatural Remarkables. So in this book, there are family secrets, there are evil villains, there's friendship and adventure, all of the makings of a fantastic and approachable urban, contemporary, and magic-filled adventure. The story follows Nick and friends as she navigates looking for a powerful magical tool to clear her father, also a Remarkable's name. So reading it through, I felt like I could also be a Remarkable. I know that there were lots of nods to African-American folklore and culture and biblical stories. I recognized words like juju and mojo, and it really gave Wakanda vibes. And so if you're a fan of HP, if you're a fan of Black Panther, and if you're a fan of magic, I think that this story will not only speak to African Americans, as it is a largely African American cast. I believe it's an entirely African American cast. But if you love magic and you love folklore, it's such an approachable, magical approach to this new story.
Would you talk about how the children's picture book, You Will Do Great Things, was inspired by the author's own life?
So You Will Do Great Things was written by A. Marie, who's best known as an R&B singer and songwriter and Grammy-nominated artist. I could definitely see the influence in this new book that she dedicated to her sons, as the words are so poetic and inspiring. The illustrations by Raisa Figueroa are just bold and vibrant in color. I would say the theme is very reminiscent of Dr. Seuss, The Places You'll Go. It's one of my favorite lines in the book by A. Marie, is, "You will do strange things. Many will not understand, but hold on tight to your vision, so maybe one day they can." You know, I attended a reading of this book, and one of the attendees said that she wished the book was around when her son was little, and he was autistic. And so, and she teared up as she shared that story, and I felt the same sentiment, as this book just follows a young boy as he navigates life and is ushered through the story of his life through his mother. I know Emery is of Korean and African-American descent, and so the characters and the pictures in the book represent a family of all beautiful hues, but it's just such a universal story of love and inspiration and just guiding through your life, knowing that each step that you take, you are loved, you are special, believe in yourself, and that you will do great things.
You have two more picture books on the list, Big by Vashti Harrison and One Day by Joanna Ho. Why are picture books important to the education of young children?
You know, the books that I chose, in hindsight, I feel like they are all pretty similar in nature. And that wasn't by design. It was, I love these books and I want to share them. But as I look back, I really believe, you know, part of why we opened the store back in 2018 is that I believe that these stories that we tell our children very early on plant the seeds of the people that they believe they can become in the world, the people that they will be and the influence that they will have. And so One Day, written by Joanna Ho, also author of Eyes That Kiss in the Corner and Eyes That Speak to the Stars, One Day, exquisitely illustrated by Faith Prey, another very favorite, a beautiful illustrator. It's just the theme of delight and inspiration. It really speaks to a mother's love as she envisions him exploring the world. You know, the last page of the book and One Day has pictures of kids of different hues and holding up signs that say, stop Asian hate, Black Lives Matter, love is love, and all are welcome here. That's also a sticker that I have on my computer. It really does speak loudly, but also plant those seeds. They're primers for some pretty important conversations that we should have, or that we will have. And so, but in a very bite-sized way.
Oh, and I love the way the author reassures boys that, quoting here, life will pull tears that roll like rivers over your cheeks. Let them roll, sweet boy. Softness is a sign of strength.
Yes. I remember that. Well, I have a 10-year-old son as well. And I think about these books that just provide such great moments of connection, such great moments of starting conversations that you may not know where to start. It illustrates it beautifully. It opens up an opportunity for conversation and to explore. You know, one of the things we say about the books that we try and share at Brave and Kind is we're planting seeds for the people that we want to raise and be in the world. And so I'm hoping that folks will read these books and see themselves and see who they can be.
Bunny, how does Big explore the idea of self-love and bring home the power of words?
Right. You know, Vashti Harrison, who is just such an amazing illustrator, this is her first picture book that she wrote and illustrated. And it traces a child's journey through self-love and shows the power of words. You know, she writes in her author's note, in childhood, big is good. Big is impressive and aspirational. But somewhere along the way, the world begins to tell us something different, that big is bad, that being big is undesirable. And so, you know, she mentions that her size indicated to adults that she was big enough to know better, even though she was still just a kid. And I remember that as a mom, to saying to my children, oh, you're such a big boy for doing this great thing, or you're such a big girl for finishing your plate. And so somewhere along the way, we start to change that narrative. And Big is such a beautiful story that teaches us to be more thoughtful about the things that we say and how we say them, and teaches us to love each other and to love ourselves, and that being big and taking up space is a good thing. Hmm.
For those looking to expand their vocabulary, why would The Swifts by Beth Lincoln be a good choice?
I love it. I love The Swifts. It's such a fun book. A couple of months ago, I attended an event in Seattle for booksellers where the author Beth Lincoln presented the book The Swifts, and I immediately fell in love with the story. If you're a fan of Lemony Snicket and A Series of Unfortunate Events, which we were in our house, and I can remember many car rides to school listening to that series of books. My ears perked up. If you like mysteries, if you like books about family and have a slightly creepy sense of humor, you'll love The Swifts. You know, to start, on the day that they're born, every Swift child is brought before a sacred family dictionary, and they're given a name and a definition that they're assumed to grow up to match. And so The story largely revolves around the sisters, Felicity, who's fashionable and fluent in French, and Phenomena, a brilliant scientist who's lost her sense of smell in an experiment, and Shenanigan, who is the main character who is usually up to something. And so as they grapple with each other and living up to their given names, what I like about the book is that they're the sisters, they're learning for themselves, that there will always be people who think that they know you better than yourself. But I quickly learned, actually, this is one of the lines from the book, but I quickly learned that they don't matter, and the people that you love are the people that will listen. And so I just think it is lends itself to being a fun family read aloud, a fun road trip listen to, or something to dive into at the beach or on your back porch this summer.
Bunny Hilliard, owner of Brave and Kind Bookshop. More information about her summer reading list is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. In a moment, summer reading suggestions for adults from writer and self-proclaimed book evangelist Allison Law. Amplifying Atlanta, this is WABE.
Now on view at Skadfash, Manish Arora's Life is Beautiful. Renowned for dazzling designs in a rainbow of colors, Manish Arora has brought the talent and craftsmanship of India's rich sartorial history to the global forefront, earning international acclaim on runways across three continents. Designing in India since the 1990s, Arora's glittering garments celebrate extravagant expressions of self through varied materials, techniques, and silhouettes in a triumphant union of Western and Eastern aesthetics adapted to today's multicultural society with a touch of humor. Find out more at skadfash.org.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. Memorial Day is quickly approaching, marking the official start of summer as we know it, and summer reading. Writer and self-proclaimed book evangelist Allison Law continues her tradition of rounding up some of the essential eclectic reads for the online publication, The Bitter Southerner. She joins me now via Zoom to discuss the books on this year's summer reading list. Allison, welcome back to City Lights.
What a pleasure to talk books with you again, Lois.
Oh, you know, reading is my favorite form of exercise.
Yes.
So, what determines the selections for the Bitter Southerner Summer Reading Roundup?
I was trying to remember. I think this is the fourth or fifth time I've had the honor of contributing to the Summer Reading Roundup, but it comes out the Tuesday before Memorial Day every year. And truly, it is a revolving list, because as soon as we get through one summer reading roundup, we start again working on the next year's roundup. So at the end of last May through this May, that's kind of our date range. And then we have titles within that range that came out in 2022, and we wrap up with one that's coming out on May 30th. And so I start compiling the list of titles and authors. This year, I think it was close to 200 different books that fell within those parameters. And the books, the writers, often both have some tie to the US South. Representation matters. You know, there's no one South, and there's no one author or book that represents contemporary Southern literature. So I devote a lot of time to seeking out titles from different states within the US South. And you will find young debut poets from small presses in the same list as some really well-established big name authors from big publishers.
Well, one of those big name authors on your list recently won a Pulitzer Prize. Please tell us about Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver.
Yes, it's a wonderful, wonderful honor, well-deserved honor. The Pulitzer Committee named Demon Copperhead actually one of two prize winners for fiction. It's the first time they've had two different fiction winners. The other was Hernan Diaz's book, Trust. So it's a great, great year for Pulitzer winners. You know, Kingsolver is a native of Kentucky. She still lives in the Appalachian area. And before this book, she was probably best known for 1998's The Poisonwood Bible. She says that Demon Copperhead is the first Appalachian novel to win the Pulitzer since A Death in the Family by James Agee in 1958. So thank goodness that we have that representation. You know, and I actually, Lois, decided, because this is the kind of book nerd I am, that because I hadn't read David Copperfield before, and I'm a huge fan of Charles Dickens, I would read David Copperfield and Demon Copperfield at the same, you can't even say them the same way, at the same time. Demon Copperhead is Kingsolver's novel, at the same time.
I am so impressed, but not surprised, Allison.
And what's happened was, I mean, obviously, Dickens was talking about the Victorian era and the issues that we had around taking care of the poor in our society and the children who are orphans. And it's just amazing that in a contemporary novel, we're trying to highlight some of the same issues that we have. And Demon is a very, while he's still your coming of age, unreliable narrator, he's a very smart, unreliable narrator, and you just come to love him and the things that he learns on his journey. So I think it's the voice. You know, the Pulitzer Committee wrote that Kingsolver's recasting of David Copperfield is narrated by Demon, who's wise and unwavering voice. And I think that's the voice that you will remember well after you turn the last page.
What is it about his voice that especially moved you?
It is just some of the, I remember some of the conversations that he has with others or the things that we witness through his point of view. And some of the, you know, he grew up to a teenage mom. He was born, his father had already died before he was born, and they grew up in a holler in a trailer. And he had his best friend and their family next door. He just learns some of the bluntest truths that our region is struggling with: addiction, with poverty, being under-resourced. And he takes them in stride, and it can be a very sad book at times, but it also has just this, what I keep referring to as relentless hope.
Mm. The Bitter Southerners Summer Reading Roundup features some other novels from the Appalachian region of the South.
Yes, the list features two novelists from my home state of Tennessee. Kevin Wilson, who is quickly becoming a must read. Every time he has a new novel come out, I just devour it very, very quickly, because he has a way of establishing these hysterical, what I like to call the beautiful misfit characters. And his novel on the list is Now Is Not the Time to Panic. And we're introduced to someone who's kind of comparatively normal in the beginning, Frances Eleanor Budge. She's a famous author and a wife and a mom. And we learn very early in the book that Frances was once Frankie, and she has a secret past that is about to catch up with her. A journalist wants to know if she was involved in the panic that is in the title of the book that happened in 1996. And so it's a really, really remarkable book, because we go back and forth in time between Frances, the author, and Frankie, who is, again, one of these misfit, beautiful artists, and the art that she made with a good friend of hers. And then the second book is also set outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. This is called House of Cotton. And I think it first caught my attention because the debut novelist is Monica Brashears, and she has studied at Rutgers University with the wonderful George Saunders. And this book blends really incredible elements of Southern Gothic. So it's got the Grimm's fairy tales, the main character, Magnolia. Anytime she encounters trauma, she kind of starts imagining herself as a smaller, minor character in a Grimm's fairy tale. So it gets a little bit, the lines start to blur more and more as you get into the book. She's, you know, working at a gas station, and this well-dressed stranger walks in and offers her a job as a model. And she soon discovers that the modeling agency is really a front for a funeral home. And it just begins to get a little bit more absurd from there. But it's just really remarkable, the creativity, which is juxtaposed with, again, some of the just realities of living in this southern region.
And Brashears identifies as an Afro-Latian writer. I was fascinated to learn about Afrolatia. Would you explain a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. This is kind of, as I understand it, as someone who identifies as, you know, a white middle-aged cis woman from the South, that this is, along with Frank X. Walker, the poet, a way of taking back the idea that everyone who lives in the Appalachian region is white, is essentially looks like me and has the same experience. These are a distinct group, including Crystal Wilkinson, who's a poet who appears in one of the anthologies in this year, a group of African-American writers who are taking back what it means to be someone who is Afro-Latian or an Appalachian native.
The Bitter Southerner is well known for its award-winning food journalism. I might add mouth-watering writing about food. And you've included some food-related memoirs and cookbooks on this list.
Absolutely. It is not all fiction. I know my audience here. And one of the books that quickly came to my attention on this list was Cooking for the Culture by Chef Toya Bodie. It is not your typical white tablecloth New Orleans cookbook, because you will find some of these truly decadent recipes, but it's really more of, as you start to go through the pages, you see these lovely photos of Bodie's family and herself through the years. She identifies as a Black woman chef who grew up in a very blue-collar family. She struggled in school. She became a mom to her daughter at 16. And she really, through cooking, has built an empire. And she says in the introduction to this book that she just wants to give everyone the permission to express themselves creatively. So kind of an interesting way to introduce a book about food. The second book is Kosher Soul. This is the second in a now planned trilogy by Michael Twitty. His first book won 2 James Beard Foundation Awards. He explored his African-American and Southern culture. And Kosher Soul focuses on the intersection of his Jewish heritage and his other identities as a Black queer man living in the South. And Bishwesh Bhatt. He's a native of India who gave up graduate school when he and his parents emigrated to the United States to become a classically trained chef. And the book on our list is I Am From Here. He now is so well known. He was also a James Beard Award winner for Best Chef in the South in 2019. He's the executive chef at the wildly popular snack bar in Oxford, Mississippi. And I Am From Here is him proudly claiming that I too am from here. I am someone who is proud to call himself a Southern chef. And then another popular Food Network host, Cartier Brown, shares what she's learned by embracing the food and traditions of her Gullah Geechee heritage, a culture, language, and cuisine we know well in the Georgia and South Carolina areas. So she has created her own style of cooking called New Gullah, which incorporates what she's learned from visiting and traveling to other places, and then what she learned from her mother and grandmother growing up in the kitchen.
Allison, I can't help but notice that of the 20 books on this list, not one is your typical beach read. These books cover serious topics, which doesn't mean they aren't entertaining or engaging. But in fact, you introduce the list by saying that you are more interested in suggesting books that will make people feel. Would you elaborate?
I will, because this is something that I was struggling with as I was putting the list together. I kept telling my partner, like, I think, you know, I'm not sure this is the same summer reading that most would consider, you know, I don't want people to misunderstand. I love a frothy, whip-smart romance. I did include a YA book called We Deserve Monuments by Jazz Hadmans in the list, and it gives you all the summer love feels. I mean, anybody who's craving a good young love story will love We Deserve Monuments. But yes, this list covers all of the complicated topics because people are complex. And this is the Bitter Southerner's 10th year. This was an online publication started by a group of friends that's become something much bigger than that. And in order to continue to fulfill that mission, we have to take a look at what's happened to our region in the past 10 years. And we look at the fact that in this year alone, our American libraries and schools have faced an unprecedented number of book bans, legislative challenges to drag queen performances or drag queen story hours. And, you know, I had to ask myself when I was writing this list, like, why do we as a culture, as a society, read books? And why do some people want us not to read books? And the simplest answer that I could come up with is that I read to see and to understand and to feel things that I cannot possibly otherwise. We can't possibly know things that are happening until we read them through the eyes of, you know, Demon Copperhead or Magnolia or the chefs on this list. And so I think that's dangerous to some people. And I want to introduce books that elicit those strong emotions.
Writer Allison Law. More information about the Bitter Southerner's Summer Reading Roundup is on our website, wabe.org/citylights. Coming up, we'll hear what some local Atlantans are doing in response to our country's massive wave of book banning. Amplifying Atlanta, this is 90.1 WABE. This is City Lights on WABE. I'm Lois Reitzis. Thank you for being here. Book banning is one of the most widespread forms of censorship in the United States, with children's literature being the primary target. Last month, WABE's Rose Scott had the manager of Little Shop of Stories, Justin Kalousiastis, on Closer Look to discuss this store's newly formed banned book club. Here he explains why he started the club.
One of the reasons I started this book club was because we were seeing so many books that were the calls to be banned. I think that there's a lot of things going on here. I think that there are dynamic shifts across the U.S. and in individual communities where we're seeing a shift away from an older generation to a newer generation that has their own very strong, passionate views that I think that communities are much more, to use a hot button word, much more diverse than they used to be. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of anxiety, particularly one that's being stoked by people who have a lot to gain from it. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of fear of the unknown. And unfortunately, I think that kids and the books they read and the media they consume and the world that they want to inhabit is at the mm-hmm. center of that. The problem is in libraries where people who don't have the money to buy a book, where kids who don't have the agency to go out to a bookstore and with their own money buy a book, those are the people that are being denied these books because those are the spaces that are most at risk. You know, I always tell people, yes, please buy this book here. Please read it. Please challenge, you know, understand, engage these ideas in this space, but also go and support your library.
You can hear Rose's entire interview with the manager of Little Shop of Stories, Justin Kalousiastis, on wabe.org/closerlook. Individual Atlantans are also fighting back against censorship, and one local citizen is bringing banned books to pop-up locations around the metro area. City Lights producer Summer Evans has more.
Book bans are continuing to rise in both schools and public libraries across the country. Atlanta artist Aileen Loy decided to do something about it. She created pop-up libraries containing banned books. It's called the Little Free Contentious Library.
When I started collecting books for the libraries, I used a list that was generated in Texas of 850 banned or challenged titles. The list has almost doubled since then. A few of the titles that I like to keep on hand at all times are 1619 Project, How to Be Anti-Racist, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, I Am Ruby Bridges, The Bluest Eye, All Boys Aren't Blue, and Hair Love.
Loy started the project in 2020 with 5 abandoned newspaper stacks. It has since grown to over 20 across Metro Atlanta and in a few neighboring states.
The responses have been overwhelmingly positive. I've done a few banned book pop-ups, and it's interesting to see people interact with the boxes. Sometimes they'll open the door expecting something a tad illicit, and almost every time there's a shocked laugh followed by, "What? I read this in school." It definitely leads to some interesting conversations.
She is currently raising money on GoFundMe for a banned book mobile, a van that would deliver banned books to more restrictive areas.
Thank you, Summer. More information about the banned book pop-ups is on Aileen Loy's Instagram. You can find her at Aileen Loy Artist. One of the books Aileen said she likes to keep on hand at all times is How to Be an Anti-Racist, the 2019 nonfiction book by the American author and historian Ibram X. Kendi. Last year, the New Yorker cartoonist Victor Varnado decided to add to Kendi's idea, and he created the Anti-Racism Activity Book in the style of a children's puzzle and coloring book. When I spoke with Varnado in February, he began with how he presents himself to readers in the About the Author section of his book.
People who don't know me are usually quick to figure out that I am a Black person who has albinism. And so I have very light skin and light hair and have often been mistaken for white in just my lifetime. And so I talk about that at the very beginning of the book and just that I have been around white people when they didn't know someone Black is around and have been around Black people when they did not know that I was also Black. So I have seen some stuff, is what I say in the book.
Oh, yes. And what stories to tell. Would you describe some of the activities in your anti-racist book?
It's actually anti-racism, but the reason that I make that
distinction—oh,
it's quite all right—but I make that distinction for a reason, because I didn't want to make the book against people. I wanted to make it against the act of racism, because if you're saying the book is, you know, against a person who is racist, then I don't want to label people. I want to give people a chance to make their own decisions. And so that's why it's against racism, which I think everyone can agree with.
I would hope so. And thank you for catching my typo and worse, possibly misunderstanding there.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for hearing me out about it. And the book itself, the activities in the book are actually around that idea. I'm trying to present things in the book about racism in such a way where I think that most people will agree with the points that I'm trying to make. For instance, there's a page in the book which is mostly blank, except at the top of the page, it says, "This page is reserved for every white person who needs to say the N-word." And then at the bottom of the page, I put, "If you disagree, feel free to draw yourself in." So I feel like most people can understand, you know, that page could stay blank and it wouldn't be a problem.
No, it would be a great thing, in fact. I'm curious about anyone who's actually drawn themselves in.
So I would be as well.
Oy, I don't want to think about it. Many of the entries are very funny. And then we encounter a cartoon that is searing or stunning with its message. Tell us about the connect the dots example with Eric.
So there's a cartoon in the book where you have a black man looking over his shoulder, and it's saying connect the dots to draw the target on Eric's back, because there's a target on his back as a black man. It's no surprise to people at this point that there are cases where black people and men especially have been in jeopardy because of the way that society is set up. And a lot of people, I think, have the idea that societal racism or institutional racism, they say, doesn't exist. But from a black person's point of view, there are many men who are black who have been singled out by the police in a fashion that people of other races, or particularly white races, have not been singled out. And it's just something that exists. And I'm not trying to accuse anybody of anything, but I'm just saying, like, it's a way of life of black men, especially growing up, like they have to understand that they must be aware or it's dangerous for them.
Yeah. In fact, you have another cartoon with a father and a little boy, a father-son, giving him the talk.
Yeah, it's a talk that definitely happens with parents and children of color often, where they have to tell them that sometimes there are situations in which the world is skewed in such a way where you have to be aware to be safe. Interesting side fact, though, the Eric in that picture is actually modeled after my friend Eric Andre. He actually shared it on social media, the picture, after he saw it.
The weapon hunt is another display of irony. Would you describe it?
Yes. While researching this book, I actually was surprised at some of the things that I found, too. For instance, weapon hunt was one of those where I was like, I wonder what things have been mistaken for guns in the hands of black people. And then through my research, I found that the number of things that have been mistaken for guns is quite shocking.
Yeah, like a Bible?
Yeah, a Bible, a piece of pizza, a human hand, like their own hand. They thought it was a gun when it wasn't a gun. So like there are, yeah, it's surprising. It surprised me researching the book, because when I started the book, I came with the idea that I would like to make a book that is funny enough so that it makes it easy for people to talk about racism. Because one of the things that I think that makes the conversation easier to have is when you don't run into the room accusing people or pointing fingers, but instead just kind of like lay out the facts in a way that's easy to digest. And so that's what the book was about. And so when I started researching each of the pages of the book, I was surprised to find out a lot of facts that I did not know were true. Especially I didn't know that Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, was originally sang to Abraham Lincoln as a birthday song. I had no idea that that was true as well. There's so much that I found out. I know. I was like, wow.
I really lit up with that. And I shall think of that from now on when I hear the song. There's comic irony in the cartoon that features a man seated in his car with a policeman. I think this may be my favorite cartoon in the book, Victor. Would you describe what the man pulled over by the policeman standing against his car is saying to the officer?
Yes. I wish I had the book in front of me so I could quote it directly. But I will say this, the gist of it is there's a man in a car who has just been pulled over by a policeman, and the policeman is at the car, presumably just asking him to step out of the car. And the man has a clipboard with paper on it, and he's basically asking the policeman, he's like, well, before I step out of the car, would you mind taking the psychiatric evaluation? Just to, you know, see how safe it is.
Now, this felt like the most New Yorker of the cartoons that appear in the anti-racism activity book. Did this appear in the New Yorker, or are all of these cartoons original to the anti-racism activity book?
There are two cartoons in the book that actually appeared in the New Yorker. Or at least there are reproductions of cartoons that appear that I had in the New Yorker. Some of the cartoons are things that are rejected from the New Yorker.
Oh, shame on them.
And then other cartoons are cartoons that I made originally for the book. And every single puzzle in the book are completely original for the book.
The calm across, calm down crossword puzzle was a challenge and really laugh out loud funny. How long did it take you to put that exercise together?
Oh my gosh, I am so glad you asked that question. Imagine, for instance, that you're making this book and I was making the book and you have a funny idea. And then at one point I say to myself, oh, wouldn't it be great if I made all of these puzzles that were funny and lampooned racism? And I was like, what a great idea. But when you get to the point where you're trying to, one, write a bunch of jokes that walk the line, that walk this line that is hard to walk, where it's funny, but it also speaks about racism in a palatable way. But then number two, on top of that, you're also trying to make puzzles. The amount of time increases dramatically. So I didn't know that when I started. It took me more than a year to finish the book the way that I wanted to finish. And I would say that each of those puzzles took days.
I can imagine. Another great puzzle was the racist mascots.
Yeah. The funny thing is, that's a common thing that people know about. So that, at least the information was really easy to find.
I was tripped up on Chiquita Banana. I didn't know that she was originally Miss Chiquita before she was just Chiquita Banana.
Oh.
So I cheated. I cheated, Victor. I had to look that up.
Ah, well, I mean, it's not cheating. The exercise is the real prize.
Okay. Well, I'm just putting it all out there.
I'm giving you a pass officially.
Thank you. I know you are a stand-up comedian. You've done improv. You've appeared with Conan O'Brien and Jimmy Kimmel. Would you talk about how cartooning informs your stand-up and vice versa?
Absolutely. there is a skill which you hone as a cartoonist that is very useful in stand-up comedy. And that skill is communicating a very specific message with very little and or limited information. Because a cartoon, a gag cartoon especially, is like one image and usually one line of text, and it should say volumes. And bringing that skill over into stand-up comedy is a great thing, coming up with the exact line or expression or way of expressing yourself that will really drive a message home with the audience. I was a stand-up comedian before I was a cartoonist, but when I started cartooning, it made me a better comedian.
I can understand that, because what you've said just describes stripping something to its essence. And that's not easy to do. Takes a lot of people, a lot of words, often not even having the words. But here you can do it with words and pictures. The certificate of absolution appears here. And I have to say, there's a lot of trust you put in your readers or activators. Is that a word?
Sure.
The people who are filling out these pages, do you trust that we each will be honest to make this valid?
Well, I feel that there will always be some sort of fringe on any sort of experiment. There's always the outliers. But I feel like most people are going to make it valid. They'll find two Black friends to sign it for them who are sincere.
That was the New Yorker cartoonist Victor Varnado. More information about the anti-racism activity book is on our website, wabe.org. You've been listening to City Lights, our daily exploration of arts and culture. Tomorrow at 11 a.m., Leatriz Elzy, the Senior Director of Programming at the Apollo Theater, and performance artist Jessica Kerr Moore join us to discuss the blues and its people coming to Atlanta Symphony Hall this Friday. If you missed part of today's summer reading show, you could catch up through our podcast or on our website, wabe.org/citylights. There you'll find a complete archive of our stories, so you can listen to City Lights on your schedule. City Lights senior producer is Kim Droves. Our producers are Summer Evans and Janine Etter, and our engineer is Shelley Canavy. I'm your host, Lois Reitzes. Do connect with City Lights on social media. We're at WABE City Lights on both Facebook and Instagram. And you can follow me on Twitter at LOISREITZES. Thanks for listening to WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.